Versailles, the poisonous spirit of vengeance. Versailles has shaped the world over the last century, and we cannot understand our century that we've just gone through without understanding the poisonous spirit of vengeance that came from Versailles. The Treaty of Versailles, which ended the First World War, not only guaranteed the Second World War, but it also led to the destruction of Christian civilization in much of Europe and throughout the whole world for over a century, even reaching us here in Africa and all the way down to Cape Town. It is vital for us to understand the times and to know what we ought to do in order to effectively work for biblical reformation today and also to lay solid foundations for future generations. If we do not understand how the greatest century of missions was derailed into the worst century of persecution, we will not be able to extricate ourselves from the morass of secular humanism and the disinformation campaign which has made generations of Christians to be victims of the Stockholm Syndrome. Embracing our chains, singing the praise of the enemies of God who've been ripping up the foundations of Christian civilization while brainwashing our children down a self-destructive path. As we mark the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War and the beginning of the Versailles Treaty, it's absolutely vital that we understand the destructive legacy which has to be recognized as the most destructive, counterproductive treaty in the history of the world. To rob the needy of justice and to take what is right from the poor of my people, that widows may be their prey and that they may rob the fatherless, Isaiah 10 verse 2 condemns. United States Secretary of State Lansing said of the peace treaty he and Woodrow Wilson brought home, the Versailles Treaty menaces the existence of civilization. And I think we will see he understated it. Marshal Ferdinand Foch of France said of Versailles, this is not peace. It is an armistice for 20 years. Pretty accurate, actually. Injustice, arrogance, displayed in the hour of triumph will never be forgotten or forgiven, said Lloyd George, who was one of the architects of it, and yet he could even recognize the legacy of the evil thing he had just been party to. Lord Alfred Balfour, hardly a Christian, said, those three all-powerful, all-ignorant men sitting there carving continents with only a child to lead them. And he's speaking about Lloyd George of England, Clemenceau of France, and Woodrow Wilson of the United States. These three all-powerful, all-ignorant men who carved up continents with only a child to lead them. We need to understand the German victories in the Eastern and Southern fronts. You often think of the two-front war. In fact, it was a three-front war, actually a four-front war. Germany was fighting the Western Front, the Eastern Front, and the Southern Front with Italy, and then also there was a Southeastern Front fighting against Romania as well. So it was actually a three- or four-front war, depending how you calculate. After Germany decisively defeated the Italians at Caporetto, interestingly enough, a young German officer, Erwin Rommel, played a key role in it, and he would later be called upon to help the Italians in the Second World War, which was intriguing. Shows how your enemies in one war can be allies in the next. And after defeating Romania and Russia in early 1918, a million German soldiers had been released to join their comrades in the Western Front for the last great German offensive of the war, April 1918. This is an interesting picture showing aircraft, trenches, barbed wire. This is pretty much sums up the Western Front. By April 1918, Ludendorff's armies were back on the Marne River, and Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig of the British forces were issuing the order, with our backs to the wall, each of us must fight to the end. Every position must be held to the last man. There must be no retirement. So it was desperate. But the United States of America upset the balance of power in Europe. In the end, the Americans proved decisive. By spring 1918, 300,000 Americans were in France. By summer, a million. With fresh American troops moving at the front lines at a quarter of a million a month, America mobilized over 4.3 million men in that last year of the war, which of course totally upset the entire balance of power in Europe completely. So German morale, after fighting 4 years and winning all over the place, it sank in the Western Front. Woodrow Wilson had been making peace overtures on the basis of his 14 points. On October the 5th, 1918, Prince Max of Baden sounded out Woodrow Wilson on a peace based on the 14 points he had offered in January. 3 days later, Woodrow Wilson asked Prince Max, would Germany accept the 14 points? On October the 12th, Prince Max gave the assurance his objective in entering into discussions would be only to agree upon practical details for the application of the 14 points to a peace treaty. But then roadblocks to peace. Wilson now began to add conditions. When you make an offer to people and the moment they accept it, you suddenly start adding other conditions. It's not normally considered to be acceptable. Safeguards had to be provided to guarantee Allied military supremacy. A democratic and representative government had to be established. The Kaiser, Kaiser Wilhelm II, had to go. Prince Max agreed to these things. They're willing to make a sacrificial lamb of the Kaiser. On 23rd October, Wilson took the German peace offer to the Allies and the British and French, after 4 years of bloodletting that had cost them over 2 million dead and 6 million wounded already. They balked at what they called Wilson's mild terms. In fact, a lot of people had already been mobilized. Allied powers, 42 million. Killed and died, 5 million. Wounded, 12 million. Prisoners missing, another 4 million. Total casualties of the Allies, 22 million already. 52% of all Allies mobilized casualties by that point. Under threat from Colonel House of a separate peace, the Americans said, okay, then we'll make a separate peace with Germany. Well, now Prime Minister Lloyd George agreed with one reservation. Britain could not agree to the second of Woodrow Wilson's points, which was freedom of the seas, because Britain wanted the Royal Navy to be free to do whatever necessary to ensure British dominations of the seas, blockades, whatever. Now the demands start to escalate. France succeeded in asserting a claim to full compensation for all damage done to Allies and their property by Germany, by land, sea, and from the air. Well, considering, you know, it's like trying to hand out speeding tickets at a Grand Prix race. Everyone's been speeding. Is it fair to give some people a speeding ticket? And also, when everybody's been trying to kill everybody else, is it fair to now start claiming, well, one side has to pay for both? That was one of the points. No reparations, no signing of guilt, no victors, no vanquished. We want to end this war in a peaceful and equitable way as quickly as possible. That was the 14 points. Then came the crime of the 11th of November. 11th of November is not a day of celebration of any sort in Germany or Austria. It's a day of mourning. Matthias Erzberger, the leader of the Catholic Center Party, who had urged his fellow Germans to agree to an armistice on the basis of the 14 points, was given the thankless task of meeting Marshal Ferdinand Foch, the Allied Supreme Commander, in a railway carriage in Combermere Forest on the 11th of November 1918 to sign the armistice. In 1921, this man, Erzberger, would be assassinated in the Black Forest for the crime of November 11th. I mean, this was considered treason of a high order by the German people later with hindsight. Not that this poor man could have seen it at the time. To be fair, he thought he was ending the war. He didn't know what was following. He thought the 14 points were reasonable. Most people did. Well, interestingly, this just shows the world's flags. Remember, we were under the red ensign with the Union Jack in the left corner for South Africa. That was our flag. The Rhodesians had the blue flag with the Union Jack in the corner. That's the flags of the world in 1914. In Great Britain, a khaki election, so-called because they'd learned from the First Anglo-Boer War, don't wear red coats with a big white X across your chest as a target for the enemy. So they wore khaki. So the British soldiers were called the khakis. They called an election to exploit the triumph of war's end. When a government has lost a war, they're going to lose the elections. If they've won a war, they'll win the elections. If the economy's good, they win the elections. If the economy's bad, they lose the elections. I mean, that's why Britain's always had that. They don't have a set time for elections like the Americans do. They can call it any time they want within a four-year period. And so sometimes, like Theresa May just does recently, thought that she'd call an election to increase a majority, and she actually lost a majority and had to go into an alliance to stay in power. These things happen. Well, Lloyd George began his campaign on 12th November, one day after the armistice, with a statesman's-like call for a magnanimous or gracious peace. We must not allow any sense of revenge, any spirit of greed, any grasping desire to overrule the fundamental principles of righteousness. Vigorous demands will be made to hector and bully the government in the endeavor to make them depart from the strict principles of right and to satisfy some base, sordid, squalid idea of vengeance and avarice or greed. We must relentlessly set our face against it. That's quite a Satan-like position for Lloyd George to start with. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Micah 6:8 lays out our threefold responsibilities. But then came the press. Lloyd George had misread the mood of the country, and the press baron, Alfred Lord Northcliffe, the Napoleon of Fleet Street, Fleet Street's where the British newspapers come from, whipped up by Northcliffe's papers, the public rejected all these noble sentiments and took up the cry, hang the Kaiser. Now, bearing in mind, Kaiser Wilhelm II was the first and oldest grandson of Queen Victoria, the favorite grandson of Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria died in the arms of Kaiser Wilhelm II. He's the cousin, the first cousin of King George VI and King George V and also of Tsar Nicholas. And yet now he is to epitomize all evil. Extortion then came in. Ever attentive to popular opinion, Lloyd George was soon pledging to bring home a peace in which Germany would be forced to pay the full cost of the war on all sides. They will pay to the utmost farthing, he roared. We will search their pockets for it. We will squeeze the lemon until the pips squeak, was the theme of a Liberal candidate. And so the worst parliament in the history of Britain was elected. The parliament elected that December 1918 gave Lloyd George a majority of 340, the largest in British history of any party, described as one of the most insular, reactionary, benighted parliaments in the annals of Westminster. And Stanley Baldwin, later Prime Minister of Britain, said they were made up of hard-faced men who looked like they had done well out of the war. These were war profiteers. And a vendetta came in. From the House of Commons to Lloyd George came a letter signed by 237 coalition members, a vengeance telegram demanding the utmost severity for Germany. The signers wanted every last pound of German flesh, apparently oblivious to the consequences of the punitive actions they were demanding. And here we see the depravity of man. The Carkey election of 1918, the piece of vengeance British voters wanted, that Lloyd George bring home, validates the insight of George Kennan. Suffering does not always make men better. Things can make you better or bitter. It's a choice. People are not always more reasonable than governments. Public opinion is not invariably a moderating force in the jungle of politics. You can see this in the trial of Christ. Pontius Pilate was ready to dismiss the case against Christ. The mob cried, release Barabbas, crucify Christ. The mob is actually far worse than any dictator. You would have thought Pontius Pilate would be the problem. Actually, the mob in the street is your biggest problem. No mercy, came the cry. Arriving in Paris with a mandate of no mercy from the British electorate, whipped up, of course, by the British newspaper editors, Lloyd George found his resolve to impose a harsh peace, more than matched by George Clemenceau, whose nation had just lost 1.3 million of their sons in the war. Clemenceau, head of France, had one love, France, one great hate, Germany. Clemenceau was determined to impose on La Boche the treaty that would cripple Germany. His fear and his hatred were caught in a remark, there are 20 million Germans too many. Now, bearing in mind, we've got someone like today, Bill Gates, who says, we've got about 6 billion too many people on the planet. Now, this is pretty disturbing. How are you going to get rid of this excess population? Who chooses? Romans 1:31 to 32 says, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who knowing the righteous judgment of God that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Romans 1 could be written over our age and our century. It was a terrible treaty. Democracy is more vindictive than cabinets. The wars of peoples will be more terrible than those of kings. The peace that the people demanded and got in 1919 would prove more savage. For it's easier for despotic monarchs to forget their hatreds than for democratic statesmen or peoples. And this is true. You'll often find kings would make peace and would be willing to leave everything in the past. But not the average peoples and not the average politicians. Just contrast Versailles with Vienna. More than 100 years apart, at the Congress of Vienna in 1815, which ended the Napoleonic Wars, the 25 years French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, Castlereagh of England, Metternich of Austria, Alexander I of Russia, Frederick William III of Prussia, the coalition that had destroyed Napoleon's empire, sat down with Napoleon's foreign minister Talleyrand at the same table at the Council, the Congress of Vienna, to create new structure to ensure peace for Europe. France was part of the deliberations, and not just any France, the actual same foreign minister who'd been serving Napoleon all these years. Why? They wanted to make a better, safer, more peaceful Europe. And Vienna was spectacularly successful because for nearly 99 years, there was mostly peace. It was the longest time of peace Europe had had. They had an extraordinary amount of peace. So Vienna in 1815 was so wise that the frontier adjustments they made basically preserved the peace for 99 years. There was very little war in Europe, especially not in Western Europe. Western Europe was very peaceful for 99 years, from 1815 to 1914. So Vienna, you would think, is an example of how to do a peace conference. And some uncharitable person has said to me, yes, well, at Vienna there were no Americans, which is a bit unfair because while Woodrow Wilson was terrible, so was Clemenceau and Lloyd George. It wasn't just the Americans, but it is an observation. Also contrast Versailles with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, because Germany had been fighting not just on the Western Front, but the Eastern Front. The Eastern Front was thousands of kilometers long. It stretched as far up, right up to Petrograd, all the way down past the Black Sea. It had taken a massive amount of war, millions of people engaged on that war, and Germany had won. They'd liberated the whole of Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Belarus, Poland, Ukraine, all the way down to Georgia. So the German army was spectacularly successful on the Eastern Front. And at Brest-Litovsk, March 1918, Germans and Russians had sat at the same table, negotiated the terms which gave self-determination and freedom to Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Georgia, Poland, Belarus, and Ukraine. And this is quite extraordinary when you look at it, because Germany was asking nothing for themselves. They added no territory to themselves. They just almost like Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, sought self-determination for the captive nations that were part of the Russian Empire. And therefore, in fact, if you look at that, gee, that looks much like the map of Europe today. But though Germany's fate was to be decided at Versailles, no German was invited to participate, for the Allies had come to Paris to punish them as the guilty nation responsible for destroying the peace. And then there was reneging upon promises and principles. This is the sort of thing that drove people to the nationalists. Seeing a war hero who had lost a leg in the war, wearing his Iron Cross, having to beg on the street to survive. And there were millions of destitute people and millions of war widows and millions of orphans who were losing their homes and losing everything they had, including their national, their heritage, their estates that had had for centuries, and being kicked out by bankers. As America entered the war on the 2nd of April, 1917, Woodrow Wilson had declared, "We have no quarrel with the German people. We have no feeling towards them but of sympathy and friendship. It is not upon their impulse that their government acted in entering upon this war." But now Woodrow Wilson's part of a savage peace. When German representatives were summoned to Paris to receive the terms of the Allies, they were stunned at the amputations to be forced upon them. Eupen and Malmedy were to be given from Germany over to Belgium. Alsace and Lorraine were to be annexed by France. The Saar, which was their main coal and industrial area, to be placed under the League of Nations, de facto French control, its coal mines given to France for 15 years. The 650,000 Germans of the Saar were granted the right in 15 years' time to vote on whether they wished to return to Germany, but if they so chose, they had to buy back their mines. It's their mines. France is going to get all the coal and benefits of it for 15 years, and still they'd have to buy it back in 15 years, which they did. In Schleswig, that's way up north, border of Denmark, a plebiscite or referendum was to be held to divide the land with Denmark, and the East Prussian port of Memel was seized by Lithuania without it actually being discussed at the Versailles Treaty. They just took it. Only on the insistence of Lloyd George, who reportedly said he'd no more transfer Upper Silesia to the Poles than he would give a clock to a monkey, quote unquote, only because of that was a plebiscite held in those lands that had been under German sovereignty for centuries. In the plebiscite, 60% of people voted to stay with Germany, but 5/6 of the industrial areas and almost all the mines were still ceded to Poland. Sort of reminds one of how Kuwait was carved out of Iraq and made independent, even though most of the oil wells were there. And that was something that Winston Churchill fiddled with when he was secretary of the colonies in the Middle East. It was a tragic farce. A disgusted British observer, Sir Robert Donald, called the plebiscite a tragic farce and the stripping of Upper Silesia from Germany robbery under arms. Then there's the Polish corridor, suddenly created between Germany and East Prussia, which had always been together. The port city of Danzig, German for centuries, was declared a free city and placed under the League of Nations administration and Polish control. East Prussia was separated from Germany by a Polish corridor that put 1 million Germans under Warsaw's rule just to give Poland access to sea that they hadn't had before. It was robbery under arms. Versailles stripped from Germany 1/10 of a people, 1/8 of a territory. Proverbs 23:10 says, "Do not remove the ancient landmark nor enter the fields of the fatherless." Considering they had many fathers, many, from the war. 2 million Germans had died in the First World War. There were many orphans who lost their homes, lost their estates, lost their land, and were despoiled of everything by the banksters. It was wholesale theft. Germany's overseas empire, the third largest on earth after Britain and France, was wholly confiscated. All private property of German citizens and German colonies were declared forfeit. Private homes, farms, expropriated without compensation. Japan was awarded the German concessions in Shantung and all German islands north of the equator, this huge area, Bismarck Archipelago, including Papua New Guinea. The German islands south of the equator went to New Zealand and Australia, and Germany's African colonies were divided between South Africa, who took Southwest Africa, and Britain and France took the rest. Germany had, in its few decades in Africa, done a phenomenal amount, as you can see if you go to Southwest Africa, go to Tanzania, Cameroon, Togo. The order, the civilization, the discipline organized, and the game reserves. The biggest game reserve on earth was Etosha, which under Kaiser Wilhelm II was 4 times larger than it is today. He was ahead of America's Teddy Roosevelt, even ahead of our Paul Kruger in seeing the need for game reserve. And Etosha stands as the oldest game reserve on earth. What the Germans managed to do in East Africa, for example, was extraordinary. They ran rings around the Rhodesians, British and South Africans and ended victorious. There's double standards. Germany's rivers were now to be internationalized, but she has forced to not only open her home markets to Allied imports, but she has denied equal access to Allied markets. Her military was dismembered and disarmed. Germany had one of the greatest armies on earth, greatest air force, territories cut away, colonies gone. Germany was now to have her limbs broken so she could never fight again. Germany was forbidden ever again to build armored cars, tanks, heavy artillery, submarines, or an air force. The entire air force was to be scrapped. They were to be kept defenseless, while all around every neighbor, even Belgium, would outnumber them dramatically. The high seas fleet was seized as war booty, as was the German merchant fleet. Her navy was to consist of 6 small battleships, 6 light cruisers, 12 destroyers, 12 torpedo boats, and the general staff was to be abolished. The army was restricted to 100,000 men. Germany was to remain forever vulnerable to enemies. Remember, unlike Britain, Germany doesn't have a channel around it. Unlike America, it doesn't have oceans around it. Unlike Switzerland, it doesn't have mountains all around it. Unlike many other countries, there's no major river protecting. Germany is mostly a plain, and you've got Russia on one side, France on the other. They've been rampaged across 30 years' war, just reminds one of the damage that could be done. It was sickening extortion. Goaded on by Lord Northcliffe's papers, Lloyd George campaigned for Germany to be made to bear the full cost of the war, including pensions of Allied soldiers. But Woodrow Wilson's public pledge of no indemnities, no reparations, that was one of the 14 points, had first to be circumvented. And someone else would have to persuade Woodrow Wilson because the president had come to detest Lloyd George. After listening to another shift of position by the Welsh witch, as they called Lloyd George, The US president blurts out, Mr. Prime Minister, you make me sick. You can imagine these people didn't respect one another after a while. While they promise him liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. I think you would notice in Downton Abbey, Lloyd George is one of the pet hates of the Dowager. It was a vindictive peace which guaranteed war. John Maynard Keynes, who was with the British delegation, would return home to write the economic consequences of the peace, which charged the Allied leaders with crafting a vindictive peace, which must, by crushing Germany with debt, set the stage for a new war. He saw that immediately. Interestingly enough, why did they hold the peace treaty discussions in the Hall of Mirrors in the Palace of Versailles? Because after Napoleon III had declared war on Prussia and lost, Kaiser Wilhelm, it would have been the grandfather of the Kaiser Wilhelm II, was declared Emperor of a United Germany by his Chancellor Bismarck in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles in 1871. So the French Empire that had tried to crush Germany, I mean, they started the war in 1870, they lost, and this was not just the end of the Napoleonic regime, the Napoleon III's empire, but that Germany had declared itself a united empire, which before it had just been many, many different little kingdoms and princedoms, to have declared it not in Berlin, but in Versailles, just outside of Paris, in the Hall of Mirrors. That's why the French chose to have the treaty in the Hall of Mirrors to try and wipe out their shame. Just like at the beginning of the Second World War for America, the Japanese had sunk American battleships, so the Americans forced the Japanese to sign the peace on an American battleship in Tokyo Bay Harbor at the end. It's that sort of symbolism. Many people miss the symbolism, like 9/11. What's so important about 9/11? Well, it's the day that the siege of Malta and the siege of Vienna were lifted, and so it's understandable why Muslims might want to use September the 11th as a counterattack. Dates matter. Places matter. There was the reparations scam. The British were behind the scheme to include pensions and reparations, for as the damage done to the British Isles by air or naval attack was minimal, and the confiscation of Germany's merchant marine more than replaced the British loss at sea, Britain was entitled to maybe 1% at the outpost, 2% of reparations, but if Germany could be made to pay pensions of millions of British and Commonwealth soldiers, Britain's share of reparations could soar to more than 20% of the reparations, but including pensions, which also would be for the French then and so on, would triple the reparations bill for Germany. There was fraudulent idealism, and in comes South Africa's Jan Smuts. Enlisted by Lloyd George, Jan Smuts is described as the great operator of fraudulent idealism. And he was enlisted to persuade Woodrow Wilson, the American president, that forcing Germany to fund the pensions of Allied soldiers would not violate his pledge of no reparations. Now, you've got to be a lawyer to be able to find out how to get around that mental gymnastics. Just completely illogical. An outraged US delegation implored Woodrow Wilson to veto the reparation bill, arguing it doesn't follow logically from any of your 14 points. Logic? Logic? I don't give a damn about logic, snarled Woodrow Wilson. I'm going to include pensions. So much for all this guaranteeing the 14 points for any nation that was willing to sign the armistice. Henry White, one of the five members of the official US delegation, reflected the dejection and disillusionment idealistic Americans felt. We had such high hopes of this adventure. We believed God was calling us, and now we are doing hell's dirtiest work. America was sucked into this war under what cause? We are fighting the war to end all wars. This is going to be the last war. There will never be another war again. 1914, 1918, this is it. And of course, there's been non-stop war since 1914. It was colossal extortion of a nation. In 1920, the Allies would set the final bill for reparations at 32 billion gold marks, an impossible sum. For I, the Lord, love justice, I hate robbery and iniquity. You can't put this kind of burden on any people without some serious repercussions. Then there's the myth of the war guilt. Under Article 231 of the treaty, the war guilt clause, Germany was forced to confess to and accept full responsibility for causing the war and all the damage done. Under Article 227, the Kaiser was declared a war criminal to be arrested and prosecuted, although the Netherlands refused to hand him over for this, where he had gone for exile, forcing the Germans to confess to an historic crime and agree to a lie that they alone were to blame for the war was as foolish as it was unjust. Here's the treaty, the English version, and here the offending articles, like Article 231. The Allied and Associate governments affirm and Germany accepts the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage to which the Allied and Associate governments and the nationals have been subjected as a consequence of the war imposed on them by the aggression of Germany and her allies, which, as we saw last week, dealing with the causes, consequences, and catastrophe of World War I, the people who started the ball rolling were the Serbs, the assassins who assassinate Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, Sophie, on the 28th of June 1914, on their 10th wedding anniversary in Sarajevo, and the huge support that they received, for example, from Russia. And Austria mobilized against Serbia, Russia mobilized against Austria, Germany mobilized in support of Austria, France mobilized against Germany, and surprise of all, Britain came in on France and Russia's side against their historic ally Germany, which nobody saw coming. In fact, nobody in the British cabinet, aside from Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, and the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, were even aware of this clause, which was so secret, not even the British Prime Minister was aware that Britain was obligated to come to the side of France and Russia. It was a secret war clause, which the British government didn't even know about. It was so secret. Kaiser Wilhelm was not a warmonger. By 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm II had been in power as King of Germany, Emperor of Germany, for 25 years, and he had never fought a war. You can't say that for Winston Churchill and people on the British side. They had fought a lot of wars in that time. Russia had fought a few wars, including with Japan. In the two Moroccan crises, it was Kaiser Wilhelm who backed down. Now, looking at AJP Taylor's list of the armaments, you can see here the columns list the numbers, the columns, the number of men under arms. Britain doesn't seem to have a very large military because it's only 338,000. But notice their budget, 395 million, is bigger than Germany's of 340 million because they're putting their money mostly in the Navy. The Navy is a lot of money. France has got almost as many soldiers as Germany and they're spending exactly the same amount of money, 340 million. Russia's got 1,353,000 men under arms and 520 million budget. So it's a huge military round that they're facing. And of course, Italy, who's meant to be on Germany and Austria's side, but switch sides to France and Britain because Britain offers them Tyrol as a gift. Britain's good at offering countries things that aren't theirs to give, got them to switch sides. So Germany's surrounded by hostile lines. Their military and their budget, military budget, is not disproportionate at all. And as for the British Empire and their huge resources they could bring to bear, incomparable, actually. If you're going to say that the Kaiser's guilty of world domination, well, actually, that's what Britain and France already were doing and America was going to do and Russia was going to do. Germany couldn't exactly be anywhere close to the British or French or Russians or Japanese or Americans in world domination. And though he had given the Austrian support to act against Serbia when the Austrian Archduke was murdered by Serbian terrorists on 28th of June, by the last days of July, there was no monarch in Europe trying to do more desperately to arrest Europe's plunge to war. In fact, Kaiser Wilhelm did the most to oppose war and to try and stop the going into war. In fact, he probably was the least to blame of all the heads of state. And now they're wanting to make him war criminal and solely guilty, which is extremely unfair. Kaiser Wilhelm II said, "It is not I who bears the responsibility for the disaster which now threatens the entire civilized world." He saw it. Admiral Tirpitz of the German High Seas Fleet said, "This war is really the greatest lunacy ever committed by the white races." He saw it. This is auto-genocide. This is a civil war. And it was a civil war. The heads of Russia, Britain, and Germany were all first cousins, all grandsons of Queen Victoria. In fact, every single one of the heads of Europe were related by either marriage or blood to Queen Victoria. It was absolute lunacy that they should end up fighting one another. It was the greatest lunacy ever committed by white races. He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. It is unjust to accuse someone of a crime they are not guilty of. There's a poisonous effect to this. The effect on the German psyche of forcing the nation to confess to a crime Germans did not believe they'd committed was poisonous. There's no better way to generate hatred than by forcing a person to sign a confession of guilt which he sacredly believes is untrue. That's what the Inquisition did during the Middle Ages. The wanton humiliation, unprecedented up that time in the annals of Christendom. Never before had any peace treaty at the end of a war required war guilt to be signed by any side. This is not the way Christians operate. This is absolutely bizarre. It created a thirst for justice. It was a treacherous treaty. British historian Russell Grenfell wrote, "The forced admission of German war guilt in the Treaty of Versailles would have been a colossal political blunder, even if it had been true." And it was not true. Today, most do not appreciate what Versailles meant to the Germans, who, triumphant in the East, believed they'd lay down their arms and accepted the armistice and peace in the West based on Wilson's 14 points. It was a colossal political blunder. British Labour leader Sir Roy Denman offered this analogy. These terms are difficult to bring home to British readers, but supposing Britain had lost the U-boat war in 1917 and Germany had opposed an equivalent peace, it would have meant British recognition that its policies of encirclement of Germany caused the war, confiscation of British colonies and the British merchant fleet, Dover and Portsmouth to be occupied, the Royal Navy reduced to half a dozen destroyers, southeastern England demilitarized, Liverpool a free port, corridor under German rule to Harwich, crippling reparations. There's no post-war British government would have accepted this indefinitely. And yet they thought that Germany was going to put up with this. And then there's a starvation blockade. Why did the Germans sign at Versailles? Germany faced invasion and death by starvation if she refused. Germany needs 80% of its food supplies to be imported. It's such an industrialized country, it cannot manage. It's not self-sufficient without imports. And the British Navy could guarantee they starved. With the merchant ships and even Baltic fishing boats sequestered and the blockade still in force, Germany could not feed her people. When Berlin asked permission to buy 2.5 million tons of food during the Versailles Treaty, the war was over, the armistice signed, the guns were silent, the armies had dispersed and demobilized. Their request was refused. They were still being blockaded. This is a violation of international law. From the 11th of November through the peace conference, the blockade was maintained. Before going to war, America denounced as a violation of international law and human decency the British blockade that kept vital necessities of life even out of neutral ports, in case these goods could be transshipped to Germany or Austria. Holland, for example, was also blockaded, just in case Holland would trade with Germany. They were continually blockading. You can see the blockade here. These are the minefields, these big dark blue sections. It said the Royal Navy only had limited amounts of area that they needed to patrol to ensure that no food reached those areas. Up till then, up till the First World War, a blockade was to stop munitions going, not food. Food has never been considered an acceptable thing for blockade. When America declared war, a US admiral told Lord Balfour, "You will find that it will take us only 2 months to become as great criminals as you are." The US warships now supported the blockade that they had condemned before they entered the war. "Once lead this people into war," said Woodrow Wilson in 1917, "and they'll forget there ever was such a thing as tolerance." He should know. He employed Edward Bernays, nephew of Sigmund Freud, to set up the Committee for Public Information, the first propaganda department in the world, and he turned America from 85% population opposing intervention in Europe's war to 85% supporting it, and lynching people with German names, and stoning Dachshunds and German shepherds, and things like that. "I'm a most unhappy man," said Woodrow Wilson. "I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by a system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all activities in the hands of a few men." He's talking about the bankers controlling the Federal Reserve, which he signed into law in 1913. "We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world, no longer governed by free opinion, no longer governed by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men who controlled all the media and all the banks." And he signed it into law. It was a war against civilians. America had forgotten. The blockade was responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of men and women and children after the Germans laid down their weapons and surrendered their warships. Its architect and chief advocate was First Lord the Admiralty. His aim, said Churchill, was to starve the whole population, men, women, children, old and young, wounded and sound, into submission. It was war in a time of peace. 3rd of March, 1919, 4 months after Germany accepted the armistice and laid down the arms, Churchill rose exulting in the House of Commons, declaring, "We are enforcing the blockade with rigor, and Germany is very near starvation." It was worse than war. 8th of March 1919, Daily News wrote, "The birth rate in the cities of Germany has changed place with death rate. It's tolerably certain that more people have died amongst the civilian population from the blockade than have died on the battlefield." And that is a fact. Many, many, many people are confused over what affected the wars. The First World War was won by the naval blockade. The German army won the wars on the ground. The Royal Navy won the blockade by starving the country to a point where they laid down the arms, even though they were winning the battles on the ground. Most people think, you know, battles are decided on the ground or in the air. But actually, generally speaking, the navies make the biggest difference. Certainly it did in the First World War. There was callous indifference. Even the entreaties of brave little Belgium, for whom the British had said they'd gone to war, fell on deaf ears. Herbert Hoover, who later became President of the United States, would be credited with saving starving Belgium. He said he spent more time arguing with the British about getting food to the Belgians. And that's from US historian Thomas Fleming. The poor little Belgium of British propaganda meant little to the British admirals and bureaucrats. Churchill favored letting Belgians starve and blamed the Germans for it. Churchill called Herbert Hoover a son of a bitch for trying to deliver food to starving civilians. Starving women and children was now a foreign policy goal. "The Americans have been brought up not to kick a man in the stomach after we've licked him," said Hoover. "We've not been fighting women and children. We should not be starting now." Put in charge of all relief efforts, Herbert Hoover wanted to feed the starving Germans, but US Congress refused. In February 1919, Congress approved $100 million for food for Europe, but Germany was not to get one loaf of bread, not one bowl of soup. Our Lord Jesus said, "I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink." There was death on the Rhine. So severe was the suffering that on the 10th of March 1919, a British commander on the Rhine urged that food be sent to the population as the spectre of starving children was damaging the morale of his troops. General Sir Herbert Plumer's letter was read to the Big Three in Paris. "Please inform the Prime Minister that, in my opinion, food must be sent into this area by the Allies without delay. The mortality amongst women, children, and the sick is most grave, and sickness is due to hunger is spreading. The attitude of the population is becoming one of despair. The people feel that an end by bullets is preferable to death by starvation." It was a criminal targeting of children. His troops, said General Plumer, could no longer stand the sight of hordes of skinny, bloated children pouring over offal from British cantonments, in other words, going into their dustbins to try and find food. Pope Benedict XV's plea for an end to blockade was ignored. One visitor to Germany who witnessed it all wrote, "The starvation is done quietly and decently at home. And when death comes, it comes in the form of influenza, tuberculosis, heart failure, one of the new and mysterious diseases caused by the war and carried off by its victims. In Frankfurt, even as late as March 1920, the funerals never ceased all day." This left a bitter legacy. In 1938, a British diplomat in Germany was asked repeatedly, "Why did England go on starving a woman and children long after the armistice?" Freedom and bread would become a powerful slogan in the ascent to power of the new Nationalist Socialist Workers' Party. Freedom and bread. This is a dark chapter in history. Decades later, President Herbert Hoover, a former president, senior statesman by then, was still decrying the post-armistice food blockade on Germany as a wicked thrust of Allied militarism and punishment that constituted a black chapter in human history. It explained why their propaganda had to work overtime to create or exaggerate anything they possibly could against Germany to try and overcome all the horrors that people felt about the Versailles Treaty and the starvation blockades and war on civilians. "Nations can take," this is a quote from Herbert Hoover, "nations can take philosophically the hardships of war, but when they lay down their arms and surrender on assurances that they may have food for their women and children, and then find that this worst instrument of attack on them is maintained, then hate never dies. This just makes us think of the scorched earth campaign, the concentration camp policy during the Anglo-Boer War. It's one thing to lose men in battle. It's another thing to have women and children starved as part of the policy of a government, and then afterwards to find yourself being blamed for being evil by the very people who are willing to take war to women and children. Beasts they are. On the 7th of May 1919 at Trianon Palace, Clemenceau, with Woodrow Wilson beside him, handed the Germans the terms of peace. These are the men summoned. The hour has struck for the weighty settlement of your conduct, said Clemenceau. You have asked for peace. We are ready to give you peace at a price. And the price was cold-blooded starving of non-combatants after the armistice. As the German Foreign Minister Ulrich von Brockdorff-Rantzau read his reply to Clemenceau, he refused to stand. We can feel all the power of hate we must encounter in this assembly. It is demand of us that we admit ourselves to be the only ones guilty of this war. Such a confession in my mouth would be a lie. We are far from declining any responsibility for this great world war, but we deny that Germany and its people are alone guilty. The hundreds of thousands of non-combatants who have perished since 11 November by reason of the blockade were killed with cold blood after our adversaries had conquered and victory had been assured to them. Think of that when you speak of guilt and punishment. The tallest man in the center is Brockdorff-Rantzau, the leader of the delegation. But there was a refusal to listen to reason. When he heard this bristling German defiance, Clemenceau's face turned magenta. Lloyd George snapped the ivory paper knife he was holding and said, it's hard to have to listen to that. And Woodrow Wilson exploded, what abominable manners. The Germans are really a stupid people. Isn't it just like them? Beasts they are and beasts they were. Well, that's not exactly intelligent. They're not the ones starving people to death during a time of peace. The context also needs to be remembered. The Germans still refused to sign. What hand would not wither that binds itself and us in these fetters? So Chancellor Philipp Scheidemann resigned his office rather than sign. But with families starving, with Bolshevik uprising in Munich, Cologne, Berlin, and Budapest, Trotsky's Red Army driving into Europe, stopped by the Polish army, thankfully, Czechs and Poles ready to strike from the east, Marshal Foch preparing to march on Berlin at the head of an American, British, French army, the German government had to capitulate. This was the death sentence of a nation. This is Versailles. 5 years to the day after Gavrilo Princip shot the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie on their 10th wedding anniversary in Sarajevo, German delegates were forced to sign what Woodrow Wilson had promised his countrymen would be a peace without victors or vanquished. A huge crowd and two German delegates led like felons into the room to sign their doom was how an American observer in the Hall of Mirrors described today. It was like the execution of a sentence. Please, gentlemen, take a seat. And you can kind of see the kind of prickly seats organized. The New York Times' Charles Sheldon wrote, the stillest 3 minutes ever lived through were those in which a German delegate signed the peace treaty today. The delegates arriving the 28th of June 1919. Why that date? 5 years after the assassination of Franz Ferdinand and Sophie. And so they fired a cannon to announce the signature of the peace treaty. And they celebrated an assassination. The same day, 28th of June, the government of the new Czechoslovak democracy sent a wire to the leaders of Yugoslavia congratulating them on the anniversary of the Sarajevo murder of the Archduke and his wife and expressing the hopes of similar heroic deeds in the future. What is heroic about throwing a grenade and shooting a man and wife in an open car? But then, bear in mind, Woodrow Wilson had every 28th of June during the First World War raised the Serbian flag at the White House on that day and celebrating Serbia on the day that assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Serbia was what we would call a rogue terrorist state, guilty of far more than Saddam Hussein's or any of these other regimes that they've declared war on and killed a few hundred thousand people to free. How interesting that we ended up on the side of the terrorists. against those fighting against terrorism. Germany was to be disarmed, divided, and disgraced. By forcing German Democrats to sign the Treaty of Versailles, which disarmed, divided, and dissembled the nation which Bismarck had built, the Allies were discrediting the German Republic and democracy at its birth. The German Navy, the German fleet at Scapa Flow. At Scapa Flow, naval base of the Grand Fleet in the Orkneys, northeast of Scotland, where the High Seas Fleet had been interned, Ludwig von Reuter, rather than surrender his warships, ordered them scuttled. With a signal from the flagship, June 19th, German sailors pulled the Seacock, sent their 10 battleships, 9 armored cruisers, 8 heavy cruisers, 50 torpedo boats, and 100 submarines to the bottom. Now, this, you might have thought, would have earned the respect, a salute, honor from the Royal Navy at seeing. I mean, they were doing what the Royal Navy would have done in similar circumstances. But no, as the unarmed German sailors fled in their lifeboats, they were fired on by the enraged British sailors. Shooting prisoners of war when they're unarmed is just reprehensible. And it's a war crime, of course. There was a lot of brutality. Not until the 12th of July, 1919, did the Allies fully lift the starvation blockade. That's 2 weeks after the signing of this blasted Versailles Treaty. There was some bold resistance. When Admiral von Reuter returned to Wilhelmshaven in 1920, thousands of Germans thronged the docks to hail him as the last hero of the High Seas Fleet. Germany could say we were never beaten, we were betrayed. The Germans felt utterly betrayed, and they blamed America. President Woodrow Wilson is a hypocrite, and the Versailles Treaty is the vilest crime in history, is how the Social Democrat Scheidemann, who was the Chancellor but who had resigned, he rather brought down his own government than sign. If these are the peace terms, that America can go to hell, said General Ludendorff. It was actually an invalid treaty. Men who believe in the rule of law believe in the sanctity of contract, but a contract in which one party is not allowed to be heard and is forced to sign the point of a gun, such a contract is invalid. It's like if you're forced to give your code for bank cards and so on. You know, the moment you're free of your kidnapper, you're going to reverse all that and cancel, aren't you? Germany signed the Treaty of Versailles only when threatened that should she refuse, the country would be invaded and the people further starved. This Versailles Treaty guaranteed the destruction of Europe. Though Napoleon's foreign minister Talleyrand had been invited to Vienna to negotiate the peace of Europe, no German had been invited to participate in Paris. Francesco Nitti, the prime minister of Italy, when Versailles was signed, wrote in his book The Wreck of Europe, expressed his disgust at the injustice. Now, he was the fourth of the so-called Big Four. Italy was, in fact, there's the Big Three. Well, Italy made four, although he wasn't as heard. It was unjust. In the old canon law of the church, it was laid down that everyone must have a hearing, even the devil. Etiam diabolus auditar. Even the devil has a right to be heard. But the new democracy, which proposed to install the society of the nations, did not even obey the precepts of the dark Middle Ages, which held sacred on behalf of the accused. Everyone should have their chance to be heard. But Germany was not allowed to be heard. From the hour of signature, the Germans never felt bound. In the Vorwärts, unofficial voice of Berlin, they wrote, "We must never forget it is only a scrap of paper. Treaties based on violence can keep their validity only as long as force exists. Do not lose hope. The resurrection day comes." And so there was resistance from the very beginning. Britain gained. Lloyd George had wanted a peace that would enlarge the British Empire, satisfy the press, have the jingoes cheering him in the house, eliminate Germany as a commercial rival and as a world power. And he got it all. He got the German High Seas Fleet. He got the Kaiser's colonies. He got the German merchant marine. He got the promise of full reparations. And then there was the French ambition. The French had lost 1.375 million soldiers, so 1,375,000 soldiers, and millions more wounded, maimed or crippled. She had demanded crippling compensations and terms of peace that would guarantee Germany would never again be able to resist France. Bear in mind, France had been the biggest threat to world peace up to that point. I mean, they had started how many different wars? 7 Years' War, 30 Years' War. You can keep going on. And, of course, the Napoleonic Wars and French Revolutionary Wars and so on. And not to mention the 1870 war. So up to then, people had been trying to contain France. Clemenceau wanted to detach all German lands west of the Rhine and create a Rhinish Rhineland, a buffer state to occupy east bank of the river with Allied troops for 30 years. Pointcare Lorena wanted to annex all 10,000 square miles of the Rhineland, as did Marshal Foch. Annexing the Rhineland would have put 5 million Germans and much of Germany's industrial might under permanent French control, sort of like our Witwatersrand. Wilson recoiled at so flagrant a violation of his principle of self-determination. But that's just speaking about Germany. Then there was the destruction of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. After Germany mounted the scaffold came the turn of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And under the treaties of Saint-Germain and Trianon, which are parts of Versailles, that ancient empire was butchered, cut to pieces to be distributed to nations that had supported the Allies. Northern provinces went to the new Poland. Czechoslovakia, which had never existed before, it doesn't exist now either, emerged as a new state in 1918 under Thomas Masaryk. They were given rule over 3.5 million Germans, 3 million Slovaks, 1 million Hungarians, 500,000 Ruthenes, 150,000 Poles, all of which resenting having to live in a country dominated by 7 million Czechs. What happened to self-determination? There was a dangerous injustice. This is an ethnic linguistic map of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and how it was divided up. To coerce over 3 million Germans to come under Czech rule that most of them despised was fiercely argued at Paris. On March 10th, the chief of the field mission for the US delegation, Archibald Coolidge, called it a grave mistake, and he filed a memorandum in which he proposed a frontier almost the same as that established in 1938 after Munich, which some people said, this is terrible. I mean, I've also been one who picked it up that what was done at Munich was absolutely terrible to give Sudetenland to Germany. No, it wasn't terrible. It was righting an evil, a wrong, which all the British leaders had admitted was wrong from Lloyd George on, from Versailles. Versailles had put Germans and Austrians into Czechoslovakia, which shouldn't have been there. And so this was reversing it without war. It was the right thing to do. And the way that people damned to hell Chamberlain for doing the honorable thing here. Now, he did foolish thing later, mainly taking Winston Churchill and his first Lord, the Admiralty, following, allowing him to invade Norway, creating a debacle which brought down his government, enabling Churchill to have a coup and become prime minister without an election. But you cannot blame the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, for what he did at Munich, because all he did was right the wrong of Versailles. Coolidge's reasoning was as follows. To grant to Czechoslovaks all the territory they demand would not only be an injustice to millions of people unwilling to come under Czech rule, but would be dangerous and perhaps fatal to the future of the new state. In Bohemia, the relations between the Czechs and the Germans have been growing steadily worse over the last 3 months. The hostility between them is now intense. The bloodshed on March 3rd when Czech soldiers in several towns fired on German crowds was shed in a manner that is not easily forgiven. Most people forget what the context was. It was a disastrous decision. Sadovka's Jan Smuts also warned, not that I'm exactly a fan of Jan Smuts, but he could see this is not going to work. He warned that Czech lust for land, Hungarian as well as German, will bring disastrous results. With some millions of Germans already included in Bohemian North, the further inclusion of some 400,000 or 500,000 Magyars, Hungarians, in the south would be a very serious matter for the young state, besides a grave violation of the principles of nationality involved. To rob the needy of justice, to take what is right from the poor of my people, that widows may be the prey and that they may rob the fatherless, God condemns it. Edward Bernays deceived the Allies at Paris. The Big Four did not heed Smuts, they did not heed Coolidge. They listened to Edward Bernays, the Czech foreign minister who later became president of Czech. On the eve of Munich in 1938, Lloyd George charged Bernays with having deceived the Allies at Paris. That is, getting his just deserts, having taken away from what they'd stolen back in 1919. A false witness will not go unpunished, and he who speaks lies will not escape. The Czechs had a coup. Why did the Czechs succeed at Paris at the expense of all their neighbors? First of all, they chose the winning side. Secondly, the new territories had come at the expense of Germany, Austria, and Hungary, who the Allies wanted to weaken and punish. No pity must be shown to Hungary, said André Tardieu, who is the father of Trianon, who chaired the committee dealing with the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Czechs knew what they wanted. They were resolute and ruthless in taking it. As Austria and Hungary were reeling in shock in 1918, Czech troops moved into Slovakia. Possession is 9/10 of the law kind of thing. They then seized the Polish enclave of Teschen, whose coal heated the foyers and powered the industry of Central Europe from Krakow to Vienna, and the occupied German Bohemia, which would later become known as Sudetenland. Clemenceau supported Czech seizures, anything at the expense of Germany and Austria he was for. By the time Masaryk and Beneš and allies had finished, they'd created a new country, Czechoslovakia, that never existed before, doesn't exist anymore either, the 10th most industrialized nation on earth, having stripped Austria and Hungary of 70 to 80% of the industry, from their china, their glass factories, to their sugar processors, to their breweries of Pilsen, the Skoda Arms Works, which produced world-class armaments, locomotives, auto and machinery. It was grand theft. You shall not covet your neighbor's house or anything that belongs to your neighbors. Now, I'm sure you can already see there's quite a connection with South Africa's history here too. And it's going to have consequences when people steal things that aren't theirs. This was a powder keg that would incite new wars. The new nation, one half Czech, one fourth German, with Slovaks and Hungarians constituting a fifth of the population, was bordered by four nations, Austria, Germany, Hungary, and Poland, all of which bore deep grievances against the territorial theft. How can a country survive when it's stolen from every one of its neighbors? The peace conference, wrote David Andelman in a shattered piece, has turned Czechoslovakia into a polyglot highway from Germany to the Balkans with a fifth column in its midst. Getting treasures by a lying tongue is the fleeting fancy of those who seek death. The Austrians were betrayed. South Tyrol, to the bitterness of its 200,000 Austrian inhabitants, was turned over to Italy as a reward for switching sides and joining allies in 1915. Vienna, seat of one of the greatest empires of Christendom, which had for centuries protected Europe from the Turks, was now the capital of a tiny landlocked country of fewer than 7 million people. Trianon dismembered Hungary. Hungary was another victim of every sort of prejudice, desire, and ultimate diplomatic and political error of the politicians gathered in Paris. Hungary had no advocate there. By the Treaty of Trianon, signed on the 4th of June 1920, Hungary was mutilated, the kingdom reduced from an imperial domain of 125,000 square miles to a landlocked nation of 36,000 square miles. Transylvania and the 2 million Hungarians residing went to Romania as a reward for joining the Allies. I wondered how there were so many Hungarians in Romania when I was ministering there. And I discovered why when studying the Versailles Treaty. Slovakia was handed over to the Czechs. Other Hungarian lands went to the Kingdom of the Serbs, the Croats, and the Slovenes. Yugoslavia, which was created by Versailles and doesn't exist anymore either. Hungary, which might have played a key role in Clemenceau's cordon sanitaire, became a victim on every side. Treachery at Trianon. The U.S. Congress refused to approve the Treaty of Trianon and in August 1920 signed a separate peace. The Hungarians regarded the imposed peace of Trianon as a national crucifixion. It was the greatest national disaster since the Battle of the Mohawks in 1526, which led to a century and a half of Ottoman-Turkish occupation. The Allies had lots of empty promises. On the 1st of February 1918, Woodrow Wilson told the world, there shall be no annexations, no contributions, no punitive damages. People are not to be handed about from one sovereignty to the other by an international conference. This is what he promised for those who would agree to the armistice. Self-determination, he said, is not a mere phrase. Every territorial settlement involved in this war must be made in interest and for the benefit of the population concerned, and not as part of any mere adjustment or compromise of claims amongst rival states. Well, everything he promised, he violated. Every trust made was betrayed. What Woodrow Wilson promised to the world and the nations that laid down arms would not happen, did happen. And it happened with his collusion and his agreement. Joseph Cardinal Menzetti, primate of Hungary, looked back in his memoirs upon the injustice done to his nation and his people at Paris. And the Hungarians have not forgotten. Beneš and Masaryk showed fraudulent maps and statistics to other delegates at the conference, and President Wilson had proclaimed the right of self-determination, but this principle was completely ignored when allies lopped off two-thirds of Hungary. No one bothered to consult the people about their wishes in Eastern Europe. Of the 18 million under Hungarian rule in 1910, 10 million were taken away. Of the lost 10 million, 3 million were of Hungarian nationality. Hungarian bitterness at the Wilsonian peace was as deep as it was in Germany. You wonder why Hungary was an ally of Germany in the Second World War? Well, just read the Treaty of Versailles. They were all denied their right of self-determination. At Paris, Germans, Austrians, and Hungarians had no right of self-determination because the Allies would veto it. Germans were handed over to Denmark, Belgium, France, Italy, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Lithuania without their consent. Plebiscites were granted to people who wished to break free of German rule, but in Alsace, Lorraine, Danzig, the Polish Corridor, Memel, Bohemia, South Tyrol, Germans were denied any chance of plebiscite or referendum. No voice in choosing which nation to which they wished to belong. 3 million Hungarians were forced marched into new nations where they were oppressed. By 1920, 885,000 Hungarians were under Czech rule, 1.7 million under Romanian rule, 420,000 under Serb rule. Artificial countries that could not last, like Yugoslavia. The little entente of Romania, Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia was created out of a fear of Hungary, whose lands and people each wanted torn away. So they were promoted by an allied with France, and serious statesmen like George Kennan regarded it with scorn. This little entente of which the Czechs, with French encouragement, have tried to base the security, was an artificial, unwise arrangement founded in the quicksands of a vengeful, emotional, unrealistic spirit that had dominated French policy in the years just after World War I. And this is what the Versailles Treaty did. You can see here the areas lost by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You can see the purple. Areas lost by Germany. You can see that here. And the areas lost by Russia. Well, those were self-determination of real nations. Czechoslovakia. As for the newborn nations created at Paris, they were almost as multi-ethnic as the Habsburg Empire, but they lacked the history, the lineage, and the moral authority of the Habsburg Empire. Czechoslovakia was only half Czech. Germans, Slovaks, Hungarians, Poles, Ukrainians were handed over to Prague. Yugoslavia, you can see, Yugoslavia was basically Serbia being given a whole chunk of what had been the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, what they called Yugoslavia, or land of the South Slavs, contained Bosnian Muslims, Montenegrins, Hungarians, Bulgarians, forcibly transferred to the new treaty. Six nations, five languages, four religions, three calendars, two alphabets, but only one political party under Tito, the Communist Party. Absolutely insane. No wonder Yugoslavia doesn't exist anymore. It was a creation of Versailles, and it was an absolute catastrophe and disaster. Then you got the Polish powder keg. Poland was another polyglot nation. In a 1931 linguistic census, Poles were only 68% of the population, Ukrainians 13.9%, Yiddish-speaking Jews 8.7%, Belarusians 3.1%, Germans 2.3%. Minorities made up a third of Poland. In specific areas, they were the dominant majority. Poland was a powder keg. How would it survive? Woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by injustice. In its short time of existence, Poland only came into existence in 1919. They stole from Germany a whole chunk in 1919. They stole from Lithuania a whole chunk in 1920. They stole from Russia and Belarus in 1921. They stole from Austro-Hungarian Empire a whole lot also in 1918. And from Czechoslovakia. They stole from every single neighbor they had. How could Poland avoid a war? And by the way, you know that Poland, at the beginning of the Second World War, was as militaristic as any. They had a dictator who looked very much like Adolf Hitler and wore the same kind of uniform. That's why you never see a picture of the Polish leader, because he's not exactly a Democrat. Even right down to the moustache, you know. Same type of uniform, same type of everything. And the Poles had a bigger army than Germany. They even had more tanks than Germany. Just weren't as well trained and well used. But Poland was a major military force, which many people thought would be able to fight for years. In fact, they only managed 6 weeks. Romania's deal with the Allies is another scandal. Like the Czechs, the Romanians would emerge as one of the great winners at Paris. Wedged between the Allies, Serbia and Tsarist Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Romania began the war as a neutral. But in August 1916, after receiving a secret offer from Britain of Transylvania and the Banat to be taken from Hungary, Bucharest chose to join the Allies. The British offered land to every single side, such as, if South Africa gets involved, we'll give you Southwest Africa and so on. I mean, everyone was offered something. Of course, everything they offered wasn't theirs to give. But Prime Minister Ian Bratineau, who had negotiated the secret treaty, had also been assured of Russian military aid, which never came. Shame they had trouble just defending their own borders. By year's end, 1916, Austro-Hungarian German armies occupied Bucharest, so that didn't end very well. Not until the final weeks of the war did Romania manage to rejoin the struggle. Yet Brittany and Queen Maria, a granddaughter of Queen Victoria, first cousin of King George V, arrived in Paris to demand full payment for having fought on the side of the Allies. Not that they'd done much, but they'd made an attempt. But Bucharest had violated Article 5 of the treaty by concluding a separate peace treaty. But yellow is what had been Romania. And now you can see all the chunks that they were going to get as a reward taken from Hungary. Between them, they succeeded in doubling the size of Romania. They received Transylvania, Eastern Banat from Hungary, Bessarabia from Russia, Northern Duria from Bulgaria, and Bukovina from dismantled Habsburg Empire. Western Banat went to the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, a polyglot nation. And so Yugoslavia was 43% Serb, 23% Croat, 8.5% Slovene, 6% Bosnian Muslim, 5% Macedonian, 3.6% Albanian, the rest Germans, Hungarians, Jews, and Gypsies. All of this planted the seed of a second European war. So it was that the men of Paris redrew the maps of Europe, planted the seeds of a second European war. The winners at Paris were Czechs, Romanians, Poles, and Serbs. Well, for a time at least. The losers were the Austrians, Germans, Hungarians, Bulgarians, Ukrainians, and Russians. Interesting, Germany and Austria, Hungary and Bulgaria, and the Ukrainians would be allies in the Second World War. Why? To reverse the Versailles Treaty. You can't understand the Second World War until you understand Versailles. The Italians felt cheated out of what they'd been promised in the Treaty of London. The Poles felt they'd been denied Chechen just because of favoritism towards the Czechs. And so Europe was divided between satisfied powers and frustrated powers, those determined to retrieve the lands and peoples that had been stolen from them. This is a powder keg. This is just a war waiting for some time to happen. It was the most disastrous series of treaties in history. With the treaties of Versailles, Saint-Germain, Trianon, and Neuilly, all of which is, by the way, in Versailles, but they're different hotels or sections within the Versailles complex. And so just to distinguish between them, you could speak about these as the treaties of Versailles, but Saint-Germain, Trianon, and Neuilly are the other allies of Germany that were dealt with, or central powers. For America, all of this had stripped the Great War of any morality. When Woodrow Wilson came home with a peace that denied the defeated their right of self-determination, made a mockery of his 14 points, all of them, which honored the secret treaties he had denounced, which enlarged the British, French, Italian, and Japanese empires. This is a war for democracy. And we're extending four empires. By a million square miles and tens of millions of subjects, Americans concluded that the 116,000 sons died for nothing. And so there was a great revolt in Britain, in America. In 1920 elections, the Democrats were kicked out of everything. The Republicans swept the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House, and they enacted the strongest laws possible that America would never, ever, ever, ever again be dragged into one of these foreign, stupid, worthless, damned wars for Europe. And they locked it down so much that it explains the criminal activities of Franklin Delano Roosevelt to get his country into the Second World War, because all the laws of America were to prevent this ever happening again. America was absolutely convinced we've been duped, and these cursed Democrats. Democrats got America into the First World War, got them into the Second World War, got them into the Vietnam War, and, almost got them into World War with Russia and over Syria under Barack Hussein Obama. But this just explains why there was such a revolt in America, because it was, we've been lied to. We've been lied to by our government, we've been lied to by the British, we've been lied to by everyone. So why did America interfere in Europe's war? In world crisis, Winston Churchill had the audacity to express puzzlement as to why the Americans ever went to war at all. Bearing in mind, he was First Lord of the Admiralty, who engineered, with Woodrow Wilson, the sinking of the Lusitania, which was carrying vast amounts of munitions, knowingly with American government, in order to make sure that about 100 Americans could die in a torpedo attack, blame it on Germany, and convince Americans to get into the war. But even then, the Americans were not willing. And it was at that point that the American Secretary of State resigned in protest over the attempts of Woodrow Wilson to drag them into the war. But anyway, still, Winston Churchill questioned. He said, American historians will perhaps be somewhat lengthy and explain to posterity why the United States entered the Great War on April 6, 1917. There are plenty of reasons of high policy for America staying out of the war after having waited so long. Well, history has proved him right on that point. Why did America get involved in the war? Exodus 23:2 says, you shall not follow a crowd to evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. Injustice and arrogance of Versailles guaranteed another war. Lloyd George sensed the tragedy the Allies were setting in motion, perhaps with Burke in mind. Magnanimity, or graciousness, in politics is not seldom the truest wisdom. He retired to Fontainebleau on the last weekend of March, and he wrote one of the most prophetic documents of the century. You may strip Germany of her colonies. You may reduce her armaments to a mere police force and her navy to that of a fifth-rate power. At the same time, in the end, if she feels that she has been unjustly treated in the peace of 1919, she will find means of exacting retribution from her conquerors. Injustice, arrogance, displayed in the hour of triumph will never be forgotten or forgiven. I am therefore strongly averse to transferring more Germans from German rule to the rule of some other nation than can possibly be helped. I cannot conceive of any greater cause of future war than that the German people, who have certainly proved themselves one of the most vigorous and powerful races in the world, should be surrounded by a number of small states, many of them consisting of people who have never previously set up stable governments for themselves, but each of them containing large masses of Germans clamoring for reunion with their native land. All this written by by Lloyd George, who should have known better than to have agreed to this vile treaty when he is one of the three most important voices there. This ensured war, not peace. About the creation of a Polish corridor severing Germany in two, Lloyd George warned, the proposal of the Polish Commission that we should place 2.1 million Germans under the control of a people which is of a different religion, which has never proved its capacity for stable self-government throughout its history, must, in my judgment, lead sooner or later to a new war in the east of Europe. It unified Germans in opposition to injustice. Rather than loosening the bonds that Bismarck had forged amongst Germans, a peace of Versailles reinforced the spirit of nationhood. The treaty had defeated its own purpose because it made Germans victims of a great injustice. The debt itself uniformly fell on all, the entire nation. So it made Germans feel solidarity for one another. It united them in a common protest, made Bavarians and Saxons feel for the territorial loss of Prussia, whereas 50 years previously those losses would have only concerned a Prussian. It was a betrayal. The reparations which the Germans had to pay to the French united them in a common resentment. Just like a lot of people in our country who would have liked the Rainbow Nation to succeed in 1994 and were willing to give it a try. When you find that there's hatred, genocide, violence, theft, discrimination, and they scream and you think we won the war and we graciously initiate the peace, we let our defeated enemies out of prison, and we agreed to, from a position of strength, and now they're wanting to scream and rant and rave and curse and lie and steal. Well, of course, you're going to find people who've been willing to be peaceful before, get a bit of backbone, steel in their backbone, and fire and determine, well, we're going to fight, and we're going to make you pay if you try to go any further. At Paris, the Allies had scourged or whipped Germany and dispossessed her of her territory, industry, people, colonies, money and honor by forcing her to sign the war guilt lie. But they hadn't killed her. She was alive. She was united. She was more populous and potentially powerful than France. And her people were now possessed of a burning sense of betrayal. They ganged up on Germany, as was put there. Guillotine and organized by Clemenceau. Novelist Anatole France wrote, as he saw victory with America's entry into the war, even if beaten, Germany will pride herself on having resisted the entire world. No other people will be so inebriated by their defeat. One little nation. Versailles lit the fuse for the Second World War. The treaty writers of Versailles wrote the last act of the Great War and the first act of the resurrection of Germany and the War of Retribution. Even in this hour, some men saw what was coming. Lloyd George in his Fontainebleau memorandum, Keynes as he scribbled notes for his economic consequences of the peace, Foch, this is not peace, it's an armistice for 20 years, and Jan Smuts. This treaty breathes a poisonous spirit of revenge, which may yet scorch the fair face not of a corner of France, but of all of Europe. He's wrong. Went further than Europe. Acquitting the guilty and condemning the innocent, the Lord detests them both. Versailles threatened civilization. U.S. Secretary of State Lansing said of the peace treaty, he and Woodrow Wilson brought home, the Versailles Treaty menaces the existence of civilization. In Italy, the wounded war veteran and fascist leader Benito Mussolini warned, the dilemma is this, treaty revision or new war. Hans von Schlecht of the German General Staff said, we must regain our power, and as soon as we do, we will naturally take back everything we lost. The peace was unjust, and therefore it was unsustainable. Versailles had created not only an unjust, but a completely unsustainable peace, wedged between a brooding Bolshevik Russia and a humiliated Germany with six new countries, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. Poland and Czechoslovakia held 5 million Germans captive. Against each of the six, Russia or Germany had a grievance. They'd all lost land and people to them. None of these six lands could defend their independence against a resurrected Germany or a revived Russia. Should Germany and Russia ever unite, no force on earth could save any of those six states. This is completely unsustainable. Britain gained at the expense of Germany. Out of Paris, the great beneficiary was the British Empire. The Hohenzollerns of Austria, the Romanovs of Russia, the Habsburgs of Germany, the Ottoman empires had been crushed into ruins. Four great empires gone. The challenge of Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany of surpassing British production by 1914 was now history. Germany was no longer a great power. The High Seas Fleet, the greatest threat to the Royal Navy since the Battle of Trafalgar, had committed suicide at Scapa Flow. Britain had taken over Germany's Atlantic cables to America. Most of the merchant fleet had been handed over to Britain to compensate for the loss of 40% of Britain's own fleet due to U-boats. Germany's islands in the South Pacific were now given to Australia and New Zealand. German Southwest Africa went to South Africa. German East Africa, Tanganyika, became British. The Cameroons and Togoland divided between Britain and France. Mesopotamian Palestine, taken from the Turks, went to Great Britain. So out of the war fought to make the world safe for democracy, the British Empire added 950,000 square miles and millions of subjects. You can imagine why the Americans were spitting, hopping mad. Lord Curzon declared the British flag never flew over more powerful or united an empire than now. Britain's never had better cause to look the world in the face. Never did our voice count for more in the Council of Nations or determine the future destinies of humankind. But a little that a righteous man has is better than the riches of many wicked. Nobody hates Switzerland. Switzerland minds its own business, doesn't bomb people, sends the Red Cross to help when people are in trouble. It's better to have a little with righteousness than to have a huge empire through injustice. Like the Orange Free State. Orange Free State didn't invade anyone. Mind their own business. Why would you hate the Orange Free State? Why would you hate a country that mind their own business? But an empire makes many enemies. The British Empire at its zenith. After the treaties of Versailles and Sèvres, that was on the Ottoman Turks, a man could walk from Kuwait to Cairo, turn south, walk the length of Africa to Cape Town without leaving a British dominion, colony, or protectorate. It's just staggering. You could go from Cape Town to Cairo without needing a passport, without going through customs, without going through a roadblock. And you could use a normal car. You wouldn't need a four-wheel drive. Up till 1960, and then everything changed. The dream of Cecil Rhodes, the Cape to Cairo Railroad, could now be built without asking any transit rights or permission from any power other than a fellow member of the British Imperial Conference. In 1921, Jan Smuts, now Prime Minister of South Africa, not that he is elected, but because Louis Botha died, told his fellow prime ministers the British Empire emerged from the Great War quite the greatest power in the world, and it's only unwisdom or unsound policy that could rob her of that great position. He who passes by and meddles in a quarrel not his own is like one who takes a dog by the ears. You're going to be bitten in the face. What was the cost of the war? British gains had not come without cost. The war had proven the disaster that had been predicted in the book in 1909, The Great Illusion. The total number of fatalities for the British Empire as a whole was 921,000. The originators of the Imperial War Graves Commission saw Fabian Ware calculate that if the dead were to march abreast down Whitehall, the parade past the centre ground would last 3.5 days. it's marching something like 16 abreast down Whitehall, non-stop at marching, 3.5 days. It was irrecoverable damage, actually. The highest casualty rate being amongst young British officers, the graduates of Cambridge and Eton and Oxford. In fact, in my school, Milton and Bulawayo, the walls were from floor to ceiling. Names of those who died in the Great War. Much more than the Second World War. Huge amounts of Miltonians who had died in the war. All the leaders of British parties, the Liberals, the Labours, the Irish Nationalists, they all had lost a son. The Unionists, Bunner Law, had lost two sons. British debt was 14 times what it had been in 1914. While it appeared to the world that the British Empire had made out wonderfully well, Britain had sustained such losses, tangible and intangible, from which it would never recover. Britain had lost honour as well. Charles Mee, whose grandfather lost all 10 brothers in the war, wrote in his book on Versailles that not only had there been a collapse of political order in Europe, but the war discredited much of the rhetoric of national pride, honour, sacrifice, as well as faith in notions of reason, progress, and the good of humanity. Not even the notions of God or representative art or Newtonian physics appeared to be in good repair. The modern Western civilization that had grown up since the Reformation was under siege from outside and from within, and it was offered scant support to the disintegrating political order. World War I and the Versailles Treaty was the greatest catastrophe in the history of civilization. A generation had been decimated on the battlefields of Europe. No one had seen the likes of such slaughter before. The deaths of soldiers per day of battle were 10 times greater than in the American Civil War, which up to that point was the bloodiest conflict in the history of Christendom, with Christians on both sides. This eroded moral authority. How could British and Europeans in general, who had just concluded 4 years of butchering one another with abandon, assert any moral superiority to give them the right to rule other people? Up till then, up till 1914, people around the world assumed, well, Europeans are the most Christian, advanced, civilized, noble, fair. Obviously, they've got the right to rule us because they're just the best. Well, afterwards, you've got to look and think, how can these people who've just been slaughtering one another, and for what? What right do they have to rule us? And so the respect for the West was devastated. With the Turks' defeat of the British and French at Gallipoli, word went out to Asia and Arab world, Europeans aren't invincible. Awe of Western military prowess and power had been irreparably damaged in the eyes of subject people. The respect for Western invincibility had been destroyed. Do not strive with a man without cause if he's done you no harm. Don't get into a fight if you can avoid it. The seeds of revolution were now planted. Wilson's call for self-determination, Lloyd George's claims to respect the rights of small nations, had been heard beyond the German, Austro-Hungarian, Ottoman empires. The genie of nationalism was out of the bottle, and Balfour had now promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine. To defeat the Turks, T. Lawrence had promised the same land to the Arabs. Not a day passed when some popular leader didn't arrive in the lobby of Wilson's hotel to plead for independence for a province or colony he had never heard of. At Paris, a British diplomat spoke of the sense of a riot in a parrot house. Ignorance and idealism leads to chaos. You notice here, Woodrow Wilson's trying to lead everyone to choir sing everlasting peace, and have all got, Japan's got the control of the Pacific, Britain's got the British fleet, France has got the Franco-American alliance, Italy's got the Greater Italy plans, and well, they've all got something behind their back. A chastened Woodrow Wilson returned to tell Congress, when I gave utterance to those words that all nations have the right to self-determination, I said them without the knowledge that nationalities existed which are coming to us day after day. These people didn't know what they were dealing with. The right of all peoples to self-determination, to which the Allies had paid homage, given lip service to, was an axe that would strike at the roots of every Western empire. By the time Lloyd George returned to London, Ireland was in revolt and they would break away from the British Isles. Rebellions had broken out in Egypt, Iraq, and India. And what nobody saw coming was the rise of America as a superpower. I mean, they were just a bunch of cowboys out there in the Wild West. You know, they can fight Indians. How are they ever going to eclipse Europe? While Germany had been diminished, a more formidable rival had arisen. World financial leadership passed the United States, who was producing and taking the debts of people in Europe while they were busy needing more armaments to kill one another. The United States had greatly profited from selling to allies while avoiding heavy combat until the summer of 1918. America showed herself to be a mighty military power. From 300,000 men in arms in 1917, she had raised an army of 4 million and transport 2 million to France, where they had been decisive in the final results. Now, Britain's policy had always been their navy's got to be bigger than the next two naval powers combined. And it always managed it until 1918. Britain stopped building warships in 1918. America had just begun. They haven't stopped. By 1921, the United States had become the first nation a century to achieve naval parity with Great Britain, which was meant to be impossible by British goals. They fought a war with Germany because Germany had approached 40% of Britain's naval capacity. Now America's equal, and they're going to eclipse them very quick. There was an epidemic of Anglophobia in America over the belief that the British Empire gorged themselves in a war in which 116,000 Americans had made the supreme sacrifice to make the world safe for democracy, only to enlarge the British Empire. So there was disgust and disillusionment. Disillusionment with the treaty that Wilson brought home would deepen in the 1920s and 1930s. That's why the Democrats were kicked out and nobody would consider them for a generation, until FDR came to drag them into another war. All the Allied powers except Finland defaulted in their war debts, and America fell into deep depression. Nobody bothered to pay their war debts except Finland. And that's why the 1920 American election presidential results were just staggering. They just overwhelmingly kicked out and you can see how the Republicans won dramatically. Interesting here, they're depicting the Republicans as blue. That's not the way it's normally meant to be done, but that's where this person did it. You can see William Harding and Calvin Coolidge and so on. Perhaps the greatest loss Britain suffered was in her standing and credibility with the American people. After Versailles had lodged the British Empire by 950,000 square miles, and the Allies walked away from the war debts, mocking Uncle Sam as Uncle Charlotte, Americans claimed to believe they'd been hoodwinked and swindled. Next time, they wouldn't give Britain anything until Britain had moved all their gold and all their assets over. South Africa's gold, actually. Before they would start shipping the bullets, bombs, and what have you. They came to agree with British historian H.A.L. Fisher. Versailles had draped the crudity of conquest in the veil of morality. You know, to claim you're doing something moral when you, just like the ANC, they're stealing things while saying they're trying to right the wrongs of long ago. You know, it's just, it's bad enough when somebody steals, but when they claim to be doing the right thing, it makes it even more obnoxious. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. It invited war. France and Britain got the peace they wanted. 20 years later, they would get the war they'd invited. And the next time Britain rang for help, America would take a time answering the call and fleece Britain of all of its gold and overseas assets first and bases. The Yanks would not be coming over until France had been overrun, Britain thrown off the continent at Dunkirk. Americans' bitterness over the belief they'd been played for fools was something the British never understood. Britain had cut the cables, the transatlantic cables, to prevent Germany communicating with America. The Lusitania had been carrying military contraband. After all, the tales of German atrocities in Belgium had been lies. The British had sent the Black and Tans to shoot down Irish patriots. Remember, a lot of Americans have Irish connections. Americans had been deceived by lying British propaganda into sending our boys into war to pull Britain's chestnuts out the fire. This was the talk. And then there was the Frankenstein monster of Bolshevism. Something new and ominous had come out of the war. The Russia of the Romanovs had gone. Atop the largest nation on earth sat a grisly gang of Bolshevik terrorists committed to world revolution and the destruction of all Western empires and nations. In March 1920, after a trip to Europe, Churchill, who had been almost alone urging Allied intervention in Russia, but then he supports all wars, wrote Lloyd George what one historian calls one of the great prophetic documents of European history. Peace for the German people, war on Bolshevik tyranny, was Churchill's message. We may be within measurable distance of a universal collapse and anarchy across Europe and Asia. You ought to tell France that we will make a defensive alliance with her against Germany if and only if she entirely alters her treatment of Germany. Next, you should send a great man to Berlin to help consolidate the anti-Spartacist, anti-Ludendorff elements into a strong left-center bloc. For this task, you must have two levers, food and credit, which must be generously accorded in spite of our own difficulties, which otherwise will worsen. Secondly, early revision of the peace treaty by conference to which the new Germany will be invited as an equal partner in the rebuilding of Europe. Red revolutions filled the vacuum in Central Europe. What alarmed Churchill was the prospect of civil war in Germany, leading to a dictatorship of left or right, communist coups that briefly succeeded in Budapest, Hungary, and in Bavaria, attempt had been made to seize power in Berlin, street fighting, this is right by the Brandenburg Gate. All these communist revolution attempts had been suppressed by the German Freikorps, but Germany could have easily become another Bolshevik Republic. There was a fear that a man like General Ludendorff might sweep aside the Republic, and this Republic had been discredited since the Kaiser had abdicated, but having submitted to Allied diktat at Versailles was a disgrace. There was a genuine communist threat to all of Europe. Here's a huge crowd of a communist rally in Berlin in the autumn of 1918. This was a real, real threat. People try to ignore the communist reality, just like that's the context with what was going on in Rhodesia and South Africa and Southwest Africa and the Congo. This is reality. We've got to know about the communist reality and context. In March 1920, a cup putsch, an attempt to seize power in Berlin, was blocked by a general strike. Germany was so prostrate she could no longer fulfill her ancient duty to keep the Russians out of Central Europe. Yet Churchill recognized the danger of the regime of Lenin and Trotsky and repeatedly urged Allied intervention to kill the viper in its crib. So accurate was Churchill on this communist threat, he called Bolshevism the plague bacillus, a new black plague, that his subsequent support of Stalin seems inexplicable and inexcusable. He saw the danger, and then he allied himself with it. It was all a ghastly tragedy. He called it a Carthaginian peace. This was no reason why the world must be thrust into ruin. It was Churchill who first branded Versailles a Carthaginian peace, laying responsibility for this vindictive treaty at the feet of Woodrow Wilson, making the world safe for democracy. I wonder whether in this reactionary piece, the most reactionary since Scipio Africanus dealt with Carthage, Woodrow Wilson still hears the mute appeal of the people to be saved in the coming war. What a ghastly tragedy this is. What was he referring to? Carthage, which today is North Africa and what today would be called Tunisia. Carthage, a great African civilization, was torched and pillaged. Its soldiers put to sword. Its women violated. Children sold into slavery. Vanished from history. Was this to be the fate of Eastern Europe? There is a way that seems right unto man, but the end thereof is the way of death. We also need to remember Germany was seen as a liberator of Eastern Europe. To understand German outrage, understand Versailles through German eyes. As of November the 11th, 1918, Germans hadn't been defeated. No Allied soldiers stood on German soil. At the moment of the November 18 ceasefire in the West, German troops were as far up as Finland, throughout the Ukraine, down the Crimea. They'd taken everywhere from Serbia, Albania, Romania. They had Belgium, they had much of France. They had part of Italy. They hadn't lost the war. They'd laid down their arms because of starvation at home and in the light of this peace of 14 points offered by Woodrow Wilson. In the East, maps of the military situation showed the German troops in Finland all the way down to the Ukraine and Georgia. In addition, German troops held the Crimea. They were in the Transcaucasian Mountains. They'd simply applied to the prison house of nations, the Russian Empire, the Wilsonian Empire principle of self-determination. They permitted the captive peoples like Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia to go free. And the map of Eastern Europe today validates the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Basically, it's the same as what Germany had imposed on Russia in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, March 1918, which vindicates him. A lot nicer treaty than Versailles, a lot more realistic. There was an armistice on agreement, on points. Germany had accepted an armistice on the basis of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. The 14 points were amended to 24 later. These 24 points were the basis of the peace. So Woodrow Wilson pledged to the Germans, under point 7-8, Germany was to depart from Belgium and hand over Alsace to Lorraine, to France, which France had lost in the 1870 war. And there were to be no secret treaties. Point one, open covenants, openly arrived at. But South Tyrol, Austrian for 600 years, was given to Italy under a secret treaty with Britain in 1915. All German islands in the North Pacific given to Japan to comply with a secret treaty with Britain in 1917. Freedom of the seas, point two, abandoned. Absolute freedom of navigation upon seas in peace or war, except for international action to enforce international covenants, dropped on the insistence of the British. Double standards at every point. Point three, removal of all economic barriers and the establishment of an equality of trade conditions amongst all nations. But Germany denied the right to enter customs union with Austria, forced to grant unrestricted Allied access to markets, denied equal access to Allied markets, losing territory and losing the colonies. Selective application. Point four, national armaments will be reduced to the lowest point consistent with domestic safety. All nations, not just Germany. Germany was forced to disarm, but the Allies didn't disarm. Aside from demobilizing some of the call-ups, they kept massive armies that refused to reduce the size of their fleets. So Hitler used the Allied refusal to match German disarmament to justify German rearmament in 1935. There was a wholesale theft of territories, which was guaranteed not to happen. Point five, free, open-minded, absolutely impartial adjustment of all territorial campaigns trampled underfoot as the Allies scrambled to seize and confiscate every German colony, even private property of German citizens who lived there, all the way through to the Pacific. Better is a little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. Violation of self-determination was point nine. The readjustment of frontiers had to be clearly recognizable lines of nationality, yet South Tyrol ceded all the way to the Brenner to Italy, honoring a secret treaty, forcing German Austrians to be given to Italy. It made Woodrow Wilson seem like a liar and a hypocrite. And what was done to the Austro-Hungarian Empire? It betrayed millions. Point 13 said an independent Polish state should include territories inhabited by indisputably Polish inhabitants. But Poland, created at Paris, held captive millions of Germans and Ukrainians and White Russians, Belarus, ensuring conflict with both Russia and Germany when those nations recovered. Destruction comes. They will seek peace, but there will be none. Fraud and failure. Point 17, enumerated on February 11th, 1918, amended on July the 4th, was self-determination clause, settlement of every question, whether territory or sovereignty, or of political relationship, on the basis of free acceptance of that settlement by the people immediately concerned. The joint session of Congress roared its approval when Woodrow Wilson declared the principle associated with the name, national inspirations must be respected. Peoples may now be dominated and governed only by their own consent. Self-determination is not a mere phrase. It is an imperative principle of action which statesmen will henceforth ignore at their peril. And then he just violated that solemn promise. Thus were sown the seeds for the greatest war in the history of mankind. It's a criminal violation of every point of the armistice. Point 18. All well-defined national aspirations shall be accorded the utmost satisfaction without introducing new elements of discord and antagonism that could be likely in a time to break the peace of Europe and consequently of the world. That's exactly a parody of what they did in Paris. What they promised not to do is exactly what they did. There was scarcely a promise that Woodrow Wilson made to the Germans at the time of the armistice that was not broken. There was not a principle he did not violate. The way of peace they have not known. There is no justice in their paths. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall never know peace. That's why Marshal Foch even said, it's not a peace, it's just an armistice. It was dishonorable and disastrous. The US Senate never did a better day's work than when it rejected the Treaty of Versailles, refused to enter the League of Nations, which would require American soldiers to go and give their lives for a dishonorable and disastrous peace. And then they kicked out the Democrats out of every single electoral race that they had in 1920. Here you can see a cartoon of peace being stabbed to death with the quills of the people who signed the Treaty of Versailles. Lloyd George, who had realized all of Britain's ambitions, saw what was coming. He returned home triumphant but grim. He said, we'll have to do the whole thing over again 25 years at three times the cost. He is wrong. It's more like 30 times the cost. Here you can see France, Britain, Italy, Yugoslavia sowing seeds of new wars from Vladivostok through Siberia and the Adriatic, through Tyrol and Turkey and Persia and Mesopotamia and Asia Minor, Syria and the Rhine cities and Saar Basin, sowing the seeds of future conflicts. This was seen clearly at the time. The dilemma at Paris was the Allies goals were irreconcilable. No peace could meet Woodrow Wilson's ideals and Marshall Foch's demands. Clemenceau wanted a truncated, disarmed Germany, weighted down with reparations so heavy she could never rise again to challenge France. Wilson promised a peace with no victors, no vanquished. The victor can have vengeance, or he may have peace, but he can never have both. Do you want vengeance, or do you want peace? That's why we taught at school to be a gracious winner and a gracious loser. And part of the whole thing, when we had an argument at school, I remember we'd be given boxing gloves, we'd have to fight, then you shake hands. That's it. Over. Doesn't come up again. That's the way you were taught at school to deal with. How is it that the British people, brought up on good, fair play on the fields of Eton and Oxford, put up with such a disastrous, vicious, anti-civilized treaty such as what Clemenceau demanded at Paris? A wrathful man stirs up strife. You could say Clemenceau might have been the worst, but he infected Woodrow Wilson and he infected Lloyd George against their better judgment and conscience. At a London dinner party, shortly after Adolf Hitler had taken power in Berlin, one of the guests asked aloud, "By the way, where was Adolf Hitler born?" And the instant reply from Lord Astor was, "At Versailles." Hitler was born at Versailles. Rising from obscurity to build a mass movement in a demoralized Germany, Hitler first drew public notice. Then he attacked ever larger crowds by delivering again and again a powerful speech he simply entitled The Treaty of Versailles. You cannot understand the Second World War until you understand Versailles. The people of the Saar welcomed Hitler as a liberator. The people in Austria welcomed the German troops as liberators. The people in Sudetenland welcomed them as liberators. All over Eastern Europe, there were celebrations because this was justice, they thought, freeing them from the injustice of Versailles. This is hardly opposition from the population. These are people in the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia welcoming the German occupation. You can't exactly fake the joy of these people and enthusiasm. Lloyd George, the Welsh witch, who was an architect, one of the three top architects, actually congratulated Adolf Hitler and took his side and said what he is doing is right and just in reversing what he, Lloyd George, had put in place in Versailles. He supported the Munich Agreement. He supported Germany taking back what was theirs in Sudetenland. Remember, he said Adolf Hitler's not a revolutionary. He was born under Austro-Hungarian Empire. He's trying to restore in Czechoslovakia what was in his lifetime put wrong, to put it right again. And so it's an extraordinary thing how they invaded Czechoslovakia. No, they didn't invade. They were taking back what had been stolen. And so, shows how what goes around comes around, the very railway carriage in which the armistice was signed 11th of 11th, it was used by the Germans to sign the French surrender in the Second World War. 1940, Adolf Hitler came to this place, and they got the French army to come into the same carriage, the same table, and sign their surrender in 1940. 22 years later. This just goes to show that symbolism goes both ways. The failure of justice and the price of vengeance. In April the 8th, 1945, that's just at the end of the Second World War, Winston Churchill, in a memo to the Foreign Office, traced the origins of what he called the unnecessary war back to Versailles and Woodrow Wilson. This war should never have come unless, under American and modernizing pressure, we had driven the Habsburgs out of Austria and the Hohenzollerns out of Germany. By making these vacuums, we gave the opening for the Hitlerite monster to crawl onto the vacant thrones. No doubt these views are very unfashionable. The men of Versailles had brought home the peace of vengeance the people wanted. Their children would pay the price for their having brought home, failed to bring home a piece of justice. That price would be 50 million dead in the war that would come out of the Hall of Mirrors in the Palace of Versailles. And would Winston Churchill should know, because he is a prime architect of both wars. But how interesting, at the very end of the Second World War, he recognized this war is directly a result of the Versailles Treaty. So, One of the best accounts I've got of what he calls the 30 Years' War, because Patrick Buchanan joins together First and Second World War and says one war. It's just like two parts. You have the, you know, you have the curtain raise. You have the what do they have at the beginning of a match? Sometimes you have the halftime. And so it was basically halftime, and then you've got the second half of the match. The peacemakers, Versailles, the end of the war to end all wars, Hall of Mirrors, diplomacy, peacemaking, 1919. These are just some of the books that I've got and absorbed to produce this summary of this lecture. A.J.P. Taylor, Who Started World War One? Alexander Solzhenitsyn's August 1914. Absolutely brilliant. And The Best of Enemies, which is another presentation I've given on Britain and Germany. And Stephen Mitford Goodson's Insight in the History of Central Banking and Enslavement of Mankind. These are some of the sources. I've got the lecture notes here with the sources at the end as well. And it's quite staggering. Any questions, any comments on Versailles?
I was wondering, I kind of lost it. Why did you say, why was Jan Smit sent to convince Wilson of what?
Well, Woodrow Wilson wouldn't listen to anything more from Lloyd George, Prime Minister of Britain. So they asked Jan Smuts, who's considered a neutral from Africa. And Jan Smuts was highly respected by the Allies. So he was specifically sent to see that Woodrow Wilson would change his point on no reparations so that he'd allow them to get Germany to pay reparations, including for Allied pensions, which would triple the reparations fees. Yes, he did. Hey, Smuts was a very sharp politician. Yeah. Yes.
Why did they choose Germany to pay all the damages? I mean, why didn't they choose another country?
Vindictiveness. Well, why? Because Germany was the richest, most powerful nation in Europe. They had the biggest industry. They were extremely productive. So it was a matter of why? Is it that the communists want to take the most productive farms and more to loot? It was just the fact that they had the deep pockets. Of course, they went too far. So if you take everything from a person, after a while, they've got nothing to lose. Then they're going to come back for you. I mean, that's why when you win a war, it's good to be gracious. Well, we thought, not that I was part of the decision making, but I'm speaking about we collectively, in South Africa, having beaten the ANC and the Cubans and the Russians in Angola and SWAPO from a position of strength at the very moment that the Berlin Wall was crumbling and the Iron Curtain was collapsing and the Soviets and the Cubans were retreating from Angola, the South African government, for better or worse, determined from a position of strength, let's be gracious to our defeated enemies, we'll open the prisons, unban the ANC, unban the South African Communist Party, allow Mandela out of prison, we will be gracious in our from a point of victory. And this will preserve peace and a chance for a real rainbow nation where not on race, but on merit alone, a rule of laws and so on. And never, never, never again will any man be discriminated against on the basis of race. And so a lot of people believe in that. And so that's an example of South Africans going over the other side by being super gracious and gentle to their defeated enemies. Whereas this is not the way that the Allies operated. They hadn't even won. They'd been almost disagreed, and they decided to act like they were super victors. Interestingly enough, when the British suffered the worst defeat that ever suffered at the hands of a native army, Battle of Isandlwana, the hands of Keshwe of Zululand, when they finally had beaten the Zulus, Battle of Ulundi, and they captured King Keshwe, do you know what the British officer in charge ordered? Present arms. All the British forces there lined up to present arms and salute the Zulu king as he came into captivity. When he came to Cape Town, he was meant to be put in the dungeons in the castle. But the commander-in-chief of the castle at that time was General Charles Gordon, a fine evangelical Christian. So he wouldn't imprison the Zulu king. Even though he had put a terrible defeat on the British force, to be honest, killed everyone, ripped their stomachs open. All, I mean, that actually mutilated everyone there, including the little drummer boys and who were 11 years old and so on. But the British did not treat the Zulus vindictively, and they didn't treat Keshwe vindictively. He was treated as an honest guest in the castle, and he later went to meet Queen Victoria, who received him very graciously. Now, isn't it interesting? The British could be so gracious to a defeated savage king like Keshwe of the Zulus, but they could be so mean to the Boers and to the Germans, who they are closely related to. It's just an amazing thing about the British. They could be so vicious to the Irish, because the Irish rebelled against them, and to the Scottish. Very, very, very vicious to the Scottish and Irish. But they could be super gracious to Japanese or anybody of any other race that they fought. The British would be very, very gracious when they were victors over other races. But they were as mean as anything to their own. It's just, how do you explain that? I found a lot of people who could be so decent on the fields. The way I was brought up with English school way of thinking is, you've got to be a gracious winner. Never boast. Never take the advantage. If you've beaten someone else, be really gracious. And then they do something like this. This was not the way they're meant to behave. This isn't the way you're taught to behave at school. That's why today you get many saying, the next time we fight it side by side. You know, it's just, how did we ever get suckered into fighting against one another, fellow Christians? Wicked. They were just overtaking Britain industrially, yes.
Yes. Did they have enough bombs to auto-feed themselves inside?
Germany's not a big country. Neither is Britain. Britain and Germany got so industrialized that without importing food, they couldn't survive. They had such an urbanized population. And that's the weakness of both of them. Now, Britain's strong navy enabled them to keep bringing their food. That's why... what really brought Germany down was the British naval blockade. And Germany's counter was the submarines. They couldn't beat the Royal Navy on the surface, so they tried to defeat them with the submarines. And Churchill said in both wars, the main fear he had was that the U-boats would succeed in starving Britain, counter-blockade. So that was the big vulnerability. You see, many people think a war is determined by the courage and the armaments of the men in the front, and that plays a part. But, you know, in a long war, it supplies. That's what actually determines. They couldn't beat the Boer soldiers in the field in South Africa, so they scorched earth, blow up the wells, poison the wells, kill all the livestock, and in the end, it's starvation that forced them to table. That is actually a mean way of fighting. Like the American Yankees, they waged a war against the South. Sherman's march through Georgia, just scorch-earthing everything. That's a dirty way of fighting. The Russians did to the French when the French invaded them 1812 as well. They scorched earth their own land so that the French were advancing over devastated land where there's no food to sustain them. And later the French would have to retreat across the same territory back. And that, of course, is devastating. The Hague... rules of warfare and Geneva Convention forbids that kind of warfare. Waging warfare against, and that's also in the Bible, do not destroy the fruit tree. Do not cut down the fruit tree when you're laying siege on a city. So I would say as a Christian to fight that kind of dirty war, starving your enemy is unacceptable. Anyway, any war against civilians is unacceptable. If you can't win a war with honorable means, don't fight at all. Dishonorable war, dishonorable peace. Doesn't matter what the excuse is, it's not worth it. Yes, Avril.
Then destroying the German economy is one of the causes of the Great Depression.
Definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, yes. This is the point. You couldn't bring down one of the locomotives of Europe without causing a train wreck everywhere. And so it was a repercussion. It's just a very, very, very foolish thing. Although the Americans would also add that Britain and France's refusal to pay their war debts had a negative effect on the economy too. But the vindictiveness, you can't damage your neighbor's farm or home without it having a ripple effect on you too. And that's why these people who think that burning trains, burning colleges, burning cars, blocking, do they really think that's going to help the economy? there is going to be a ripple effect on so many levels that at the end, everyone's going to suffer from it. So, yes, to think that vindictively bring down your neighbor's economy is not going to affect you as short-sighted, for sure. But most allies don't want to admit that there's a direct connection between the Versailles Treaty and the reparations to leading to the Great Depression. Because that means what I sow is what I reap. We don't want to accept that now, do we? Sounds too much like Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 16, Leviticus 26, Jeremiah 18. Any other observations, comments?
It wasn't just food, it was also commodities for making munitions and all those things.
Well, you could easily support blocking munitions and those things. Calvin, you want to switch off the lights? Yes, one has always accepted that you can have a blockade on anything of military worth, but the idea of blocking food was not accepted before the First World War. That was a real violation of even the Hague rules of warfare. And the Americans condemned the British for it, even while they later joined it.
Yes. The same people, I mean, like, was it the same generation, or was it just a generation that was brought up?
Both. Adolf Hitler was a frontline soldier in the First World War in the trenches in Ypres in Belgium for the whole 4 years. Gassed, blind for 4 months and so on. Interestingly, for a few months, Winston Churchill was on the other side, so you had these two artists. How we wish that they had stuck to art. But we had Churchill and Hitler in the same battlefield at the opposite sides at exactly the same location outside Ypres. I mean, that's just extraordinary. So basically, yes, while many of the people who fought in the Second World War were the children of those who fought in the First, but people like Erwin Rommel, he fought in the First World War, he fought in the Second, and so on. So you had enormous amounts of those who there might have been young soldiers in the First World War, they were the officers in the Second. You had both generations. And for many, 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 it was very, very personal. And this is another reason why there was no surrender at the end of the Second World War idea. We've got to fight to the end because they knew there'll be no mercy. And that's the point. If you mean to a person one time, the next time you won't be able to talk reason with them. They will fight to the end because they know you're going to lie, you're going to cheat, you're going to deceive. And so when you violate a treaty and you think, you know, I got away with something, nobody's going to trust you again. It's like these people here use the race card or they cry willful. It works once or twice, but after a while, everyone just says, no, I'm not going to take this anymore. And it's like if you cry wolf, next time you cry and it might be real, nobody's going to believe you. So this is the problem. So for example, my daughter Andrea once asked me, how could an honorable man like Erwin Rommel, who was a born-again Christian, how could he fight on the same side as Adolf Hitler? And I was concerned about that. But once you study the Versailles Treaty, you understand, because for many of these people, it was, we have been a victims of such a great injustice. This needs to be put right. And for many of the people, they were thinking, you know, I'm fighting for a country, I'm fighting honor, fighting to right this. We were victims of a great injustice. But you see, if you take this out, if you take out context, for example, many people will just scream about apartheid. But if they don't understand about Dingaan, and the killing of Pieter Tief and his followers, they don't understand about Vienna and the British and the Anglo-Boer War. And that's the context. And then, when were all these rules put into place? Well, while the Mau Mau were killing the farmers in Kenya, and while the Simbas were murdering missionaries in the Congo. And this is the context in which these things happened, that they brought out the Suppression of Communism Act, the Internal Security Act, and so on. So everything has a context and everything has a reason. And for a person just come out with, just take the classic at school. He hit me. Well, he hit me first. Yeah. Well, that's an important piece of knowledge. So, for example, there was, I don't know if you saw the kindergarten cop. Kindergarten cop's got this little Schwarzenegger form. This teacher's coming along and asking this boy, you know, what happened? Well, he hit me, and then turned out, yes, but he killed my budgie, or something like this. And That's a very important piece of information. If you provoke something, don't start acting like you're the victim. Mm-hmm. And that's true in everything in life. But the way they want to have it is, you know, everyone is minding their own business. And then for no reason at all, Germany just decided to start two world wars. And that makes a nice narrative. And if you like Hollywood, that's the only side you're going to get. Or if you're taking South Africa's history, one day the Afrikaners woke up and thought, how can we really be mean to everyone? I know we'll invent apartheid. And there's no context. There's no history. It just, you know, there's nothing else happened around there. It's just everyone was living happily. And then one day some nasty, evil people landed from the sea. Jan van Riebeek said, well, let's, you know, and so they make their stories. We just can't accept that. But we're the victor's version. Always ask why. What's the context?